Welcome back to the show. Well, as the 2010 Olympic Games approaches, the world media, of course, is beginning to focus on Vancouver. But sadly, a lot of the world media attention so far hasn't been talking about our beautiful mountains and lakes and the wonderful living environment we have in Vancouver and British Columbia. But a lot of it's focused on the gang war. If you take a look at some of the recent headlines in British newspapers, gang war, check this headline out, gang wars turn laid-back Vancouver into murder city. That was in the Sunday Times of London a little while ago. You might remember the Independent newspaper recently ran a story on Vancouver's suburban civil war and talking about Metro Vancouver's blood-splattered streets. That earned them a tongue-lashing from Premier Gordon Campbell, who said it was a cheap shot that the media should talk about the gang war going on in Vancouver. You know, personally, I thought the Premier going after the media on that was not the thing to do. I think we should be focusing more on solutions to these problems rather than shooting the messenger, so to speak. But as we talk about the gang problems in Vancouver, we thought it'd be a great time to talk to an expert on the subject. Stephen Schneider is a criminologist with St. Mary's University and author of the book Iced, The Story of Organized Crime in Canada. Hi, Stephen. Welcome.
Morning.
Your book, I know it does a lot of digging into the history of organized crime, and a lot of people, there's a lot of recent focus on the gang war raging here in Vancouver. Peter Van Loan, the federal cabinet minister, saying Vancouver is now ground zero for gangs and organized crime in Canada. But as your book points out, I mean, there's a long history of organized crime in this country.
Oh, long history, and that's one of the points of the book, is it traces it back to, well, to the origins, at least the European origins in Canada, and which are the Irish or the English pirates that were attacking the Spanish and French and bass fishing vessels off of Newfoundland back in the late 1500s. No, I tend to agree with you, the cheap shots in the media. I find it ironic that the British press is attacking Vancouver when London and Great Britain have an even more significant organized crime problem, and they're hosting the Summer Olympics in, 2012. So,
okay, well, do you think the situation has been exaggerated somewhat?
I don't know if it's been exaggerated, but I'm always a little surprised when people are shocked and surprised about the level of gang violence, because it's really not, this is not an isolated incident. I mean, as my book details, if you go back to the 80s, of course you had gang wars among Asian gangs throughout Vancouver with very brazen drive-by shootings. Of course, you've had the bloodshed among the Indo-Canadians throughout the 90s and up to today as well. And so this is not an isolated incident. And what we've seen in recent years, the last 20, 30 years, is an increase in violence as the competition among different crime groups intensifies.
Yeah, okay, but it may not be a new story, but it's particularly brutal this year. I mean, we've had dozens of shootings and killings this year.
Right, and that's a product of a number of factors, and I know the police have blamed it primarily on the Mexican drug wars, and I know there has been an increase in the price of a kilo of cocaine in Vancouver, which indicates the scarcity, but the causes of crime, just like the cause of gang violence, are complex, and it's hard to just isolate one cause. It's the product of a number of things. Obviously, there's always going to be violence among gangs that are competing over a finite market. You have a proliferation of different groups in the last 10 years that are fighting over a relatively small market. And what you've also had in the last 10, 15 years, too, is what I call a growth in the underclass, and that is a growing segment of the population where you have a number of young men that have been socially excluded or disenfranchised coming from poverty or disadvantaged backgrounds. And whether you're talking about Vancouver or Toronto or Halifax, all these cities now have these sort of pockets of real disadvantage, which are breeding grounds for crime and violence. And that's really made the situation a lot worse in a lot of cities throughout Canada.
Okay, there's been some interesting analysis done on that spillover effect from the drug wars in Mexico, where over 10,000 people have been killed over the last 3 years, just an astonishing number. And then you've got the street price of cocaine, which you mentioned, which has gone up dramatically as well. I mean, since last fall, the price of cocaine on the street has gone up from anywhere from $30,000 a kilo to something like $55,000 a kilo.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? You mentioned scarcity. Is that why the price has gone? Is it simply a supply and demand thing, and the price has gone up that high?
Yeah, what's happened is that during the 90s, you had the cocaine market at the wholesale level really controlled by two major groups, the Medellin and Cali cartel, extremely sophisticated. They had huge economies of scale where they were bringing in, you know, 500 kilos into Canada at a time. As a matter of fact, it was 2004 where a ship off of Nova Scotia had 5 tons of cocaine. And so when you had two major groups, they were bringing in huge amounts of cocaine. They had huge economies of scale. That drove down the price. There was enough for everybody. The Colombians were setting up cells throughout Canada. They worked with other groups as well. There was a lot of cooperation. So while you certainly had violence, and in BC you had a lot of cocaine-related violence, there were some very famous cases back in the 90s out in Abbotsford and other areas. But for the most part, in Canada, there wasn't a lot of violence because you had these two major conglomerates that were really flooding the market that drove down the price. There was less competition. But today, the Colombians no longer really dominate, so you have a lot more competition, a lot more smaller groups at the wholesale and the retail level. And anytime you have competition like that, and you're going to have violence. So yeah. You have the combination of a scarcity of supply because you don't have these two big, you know, cartels anymore, combined with the competition that gives rise to the violence.
Right. And the Vancouver police are telling us here that now you got drug dealers in Vancouver saying they can't get any cocaine no matter how much they want to pay.
Right.
It's just so scarce. So they start to lose customers. And that's when the war erupts,
mm-hmm.
when the dealers can't get their product, they're losing customers, so they're fighting over customers, they're fighting over turf, and it becomes a turf war, it becomes an issue of power and greed and money.
Exactly. Yeah, this has been played out in numerous cities throughout North America for decades. I mean, this type of violence can be traced back to Prohibition when they're fighting over liquor. So really there's nothing new here. If the government is going to outlaw a substance like cocaine or marijuana or you know, ecstasy or any type of narcotic drug, you're going to have organized crime. We've learned that from history. And if you're going to have organized crime, there's going to be competition. And if there's going to be competition, there's going to be violence. And these sort of ad hoc measures of minimum sentencing and these very piecemeal kind of measures are not just going to do anything to stem the problem. So it's a historical problem. It's something that dates back, you know, 70, 80 years, and it's been played out throughout cities, throughout the world, and throughout Canada for the last, you know, 70, 80 years. So this is really nothing new, and we really shouldn't be shocked about this anymore, because this is just what's going to happen, whether they're fighting over heroin or cocaine or, you know, contraband tobacco. This is just the nature of the beast, unfortunately, as tragic as it is.
Okay, Stephen, I know you got some firmly held opinions on these issues around minimum sentencing and prohibition, and I want to get into that. But before we go there, let me ask you about the 2010 Olympic Games. We got the world coming to British Columbia. Where do you see this sort of gang issue, organized crime going in the next 8 months as the Olympic Games approach? I mean, do organized crime see the Olympics as an opportunity?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the one word that can define organized crime is opportunistic. And that's, again, if you look at the history and if you look at my book, everything is about opportunistic, capitalizing on ways to make money. So what you'll see is a competition. I mean, the tourist market is huge for organized crime in sex, for drugs, for illegal booze. And so you'll see efforts ramped up, certainly around prostitution. And that's what you saw during Expo 86 as well. You saw a substantial increase in both street prostitution and organized prostitution that, you know, sort of lingers to this day. You'll see something to be on the lookout for is things like counterfeit tickets. The organized crime groups now are heavily into counterfeiting, whether it's currency or products, digital products, and their technology is unsurpassed. And so I certainly would predict that you're going to see the market not flooded necessarily, but you're going to see a lot of counterfeit tickets, a lot of efforts to sell these kind of counterfeit passes. And history in Canada is such that there may be an effort to try to, for criminal groups to use legitimate companies to try to provide services to the Olympic Games. And the historical precedent there is in the Montreal Olympics in 76, where companies owned by the Montreal Mafia had a monopoly over supplying of meat to the Olympic Games, not only to the spectators, but to the athletes. And to make matters worse, if that wasn't enough, the meat was tainted, it was diseased, and they were providing horse meat. So they also supplied it to Quebec Summer Games a couple years later, and basically the lid was blown off when 40 athletes became seriously ill. So I'm not suggesting that you're going to be inundated with diseased meat, but certainly, yeah, it's you hit the nail on the head. There's opportunities here to make huge amounts of money, whether it's selling drugs or sex to cater to tourism or to do counterfeiting tickets. But yeah, without a doubt.
Do you think that would necessarily entail an uptick in violence as well? I mean, we're 8 months away from the Olympic Games. We've seen the violence and deaths on our streets, largely driven by a shortage of cocaine that we've already talked about. If we have criminal gangs competing to supply drugs to people who want to visit British Columbia during the Olympic Games, supply prostitutes to the people who are coming here, is there going to be more violence as we get closer to the Games, you think?
That's really difficult to predict, Michael, I must admit. Again, anytime you're going to have competition and to catering to a huge market, which will be Vancouver, there is that potential. And the only way to quell it really is, police efforts generally don't have much of an impact. The only way to quell it is to try to engage cooperation between these different competing groups. But unfortunately, my crystal ball is not operating very well today, and I really can't predict, if there's going to be an increase in violence. Certainly in the trend around the last 10 years or so has been an uptick in violence. But as far as surrounding major events like this, it doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be violence. It just means that, that the gangs are certainly...
You guys think they can make more money?
Well, absolutely, yeah. And definitely, I'm sure the coordinating committees and security are an outlook and have been doing work to try to stem and keep an eye out for counterfeit tickets.
Okay.
But I know already there's been some spotted being try to be sold over the internet.
Okay, let's take a break at that point. When we come back, more with Stephen Schneider, and we'll get into how governments and police respond to the gang violence on our streets. We'll take a look at the federal government's crime bills, minimum sentencing. We'll get into that issue. Prohibition of marijuana and other drugs. Should that be on the table as well? You're listening to Mike Smith and the Chorus Radio Network. Stick around. A few minutes left with St. Mary's University criminologist Stephen Schneider. Well, Stephen, we've seen the bloodshed and the deaths in the gang war here in Vancouver. What's your opinion of how the authorities responded, particularly the government, when it comes to cracking down on crime? And give me your take on these issues around prohibition of drugs, because I know you got an opinion there.
Sure. Well, historically, we haven't done a great job of combating organized crime in this country. And one of the themes of my book is that we sort of lulled ourselves in this false sense of security, arguing that, in a very sanctimonious way, that, we don't have organized crime like they do in the United States. And this manifests itself in the 40s and 50s where, mayors and major politicians and chiefs of police refused to admit there was an organized crime problem. It was clear that the mafia from the U.S. and Italy had set up shop in Canada. And the result, when there was intensive enforcement in the United States, we had a massive influx of gangsters into Canada. So up to this point, even to today, the enforcement has been really lacking. And perhaps that was best evidenced during the biker wars in Quebec in the 90s. But
they beat them eventually, though. Right?
They did, yeah, and so you've seen significant improvements. Excuse me, in law enforcement in the last 15 years, you've seen greater cooperation, you've seen greater strategic targeting, what's called intelligence-led policing. and this has borne success without a doubt. But what we need in this country now is not piecemeal legislation. What we need is a national strategy. We need a comprehensive, strategic, fundamental approach to dealing with the problem, one that has specific goals and objectives and where you have a national plan, because this problem is not local or province-wide, it's national, and these groups are national. And this includes, as I argue, a need to explore options other than enforcement. We need to look at different ways to combat the problem. We need more resources put into treatment to address the demand for drugs. We need to have more regulation of industries to prohibit or to combat financial frauds and telemarketing fraud, and that's not law enforcement, it's more regulatory. And yes, we need to start more seriously debating the legalization question, because...
Okay, just got a minute left. Legalize marijuana, yes or no? What do you think?
Based on a scientific research, if this policy delivers greater net benefits to society, then yes, we should legalize it, but only after we do the type of research where we can actually analyze the benefits and the cost of these policies to society. And this research has never been done. We've never sat down and really systematically and scientifically looked at the benefits of this prohibition enforcement model versus the benefits of a legalization model. So I'm advocating for whatever policy delivers the most benefits or at least delivers the least amount of cost to society.
But you're saying we should study the thing and figure without a knee-jerk reaction? That's an amazing position for someone to take.
I know. I'll never make it in politics.
Stephen, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. All right. Stephen Schneider is a criminologist at St. Mary's University. His book is Iced, The Story of Organized Crime in Canada. Up next, Sam M. Lanny with summer car care tips. Stick around. Welcome back to the show. Mike Smith, columnist at the Province newspaper, filling in for Bill. Man, it is hot out there. It is scorching. Listeners in the interior know what I'm talking about. I hope you got AC in your vehicle if you're out in your car right now. I had mine on full blast yesterday. Time to check in with Sam M. Lanny from Minute Tune and Break for some hot weather car maintenance tips. How you doing, Sam?
Good morning, Mike.
Nice to talk to you again. So in this hot weather, do more cars break down? I mean, modern cars these days, they got pretty good cooling systems, right? It's not like the old days in the hot weather. You'd see guys on the side of the road with a rad blown and stuff, but you still get that stuff in the hot weather?
Yeah, you still get that. In this day and age with the modern cars, yes, the cooling system is much better, but people tend to not service them as much as they used to in the old days, thinking, oh, well, you know what, I only have to worry about my antifreeze in the winter and things like that. But a lot of people forget that antifreeze is more important in the summer than it is in the winter.
Okay,
in Vancouver or in the lower mainland area, and partly because it also keeps your temperature low. The other thing that happens a lot right now, what we're seeing coming in on tow trucks, is if they have got a little bit of a water pump leak with the hot weather, running hotter, starts to leak more and causes a lot more problems. And the unfortunate part about a lot of these cars nowadays is because they have aluminum engines, if you overheat it too much, you're going to crack the head or something like that. So it costs you more money.
Okay, so I guess...
maintenance is a big thing right now.
So what's your top tip there for hot weather then? I guess you got to check those fluid levels, right?
Make sure your fluid levels are good and make sure your antifreeze make sure your air conditioner is working properly. And please, please, please do not leave it to the last minute like everybody else has this week, coming in and saying, oh, I need my air conditioning fixed. Well, there's only so many you can do a day. I mean, there's people lined up right now trying to get their air conditioning fixed.
What's the most common thing that goes wrong with the air conditioner?
A leak somewhere. Usually if your air conditioning is not working, there is a leak either in the compressor or in the tank or somewhere along the line, so we've got to fix that and then add the fluid back into it.
Okay, how about your tires?
Tires, you know what, tires are actually not bad unless you're running on bolt tires. If you got, you know, a decent set of tires, even about 20% left, it's not too bad because tires won't make that much of a difference in this hot weather unless they're bolt. If they're bolt, then there's no cushion. Yeah, you'll bust them.
Okay, one of the things I've noticed in my car, too, is in this time of year, there seems to be, depending on where you live, there's a lot of sap and stuff coming off of trees and things like that. It can really, I don't know, can that really damage a paint job? What do you recommend there?
Yeah, it damages the paint. I always say to people, like on days like today, wash your car more often, get rid of that sap. The other thing is what happens is those leaves on that, they get in inside the hood, and they're sitting on that right by the where the hood closes. And clean that area up, because that's where you're getting fresh air into the car from. There's a fan in there, and what happens is when you turn your air conditioning on or your fan on or whatever, it starts to suck all those leaves in it, plugs it all up, and then you have more problems.
Okay, so for people who don't want to get stuck with a breakdown, you mentioned you're seeing cars coming in and tow trucks and things like that. I guess this is the time of year you're driving in hot weather. You keep an eye on those lights and gauges.
Keep an eye on the gauge, the heat gauge properly. As long as it stays, it should be around halfway point. If it goes to three quarters, obviously there is a problem there. Get it checked. Your fan's not coming on in time or whatever. And if it goes into red, stop the car, get it towed. The towing bill will be the cheapest thing if you do it. If you don't, if you keep driving it, then you'll end up costing you a lot more money.
Yeah, you keep driving, then, well, what? Your engine seizes up, presuming.
Yeah. Well, no, the engine seizes up. What will happen is usually it will be the head that will crack, and it will heat up quite badly, and then you go into a place, and they'll say, well, you know, your head's cracked. You're looking at $1,500 to $2,500 to fix it now.
Whereas if they had just towed the thing when the light came on,
yeah, and
it could have been fixed?
Yeah, it could have been just fixed. It could be just a hose. It could be a water pump or whatever. You know, you're looking at $200 to $500 then.
Okay, what are some of, you got any other summer tips, hot weather tips?
The other one is brakes. A lot of people forget about brakes in the hot weather. You've got to make sure that your brake fluid is clean and it's proper. If you haven't had a brake flush done in 2 years, you should get it done. And the reason is when the brake fluid does get dirty and corroded, it's not going to act very well, especially in hot weather. And then you'll have brake failure.
Okay.
So a lot of the things, like right now, especially with a lot of the new cars that we have, and, you know, everybody wants to keep the cars longer, maintenance is a bigger thing now than it ever has, like change the fluid levels. You know, like a lot of people go, well, why should I change my power steering fluid or why should I change my brake fluid? Well, it's the same way why you change your oil, because it gets dirty, corroded, and that. And the same thing happens to the other fluids. Change it. It's cheaper to change it than to replace those parts.
Okay, and if people are out there and they're parking their car for a long time in a really hot heat, especially for the people living or listening to us in the interior where it's really, really hot today, yeah, you know, don't leave, like, laptop computers and stuff in your car. Stuff can get damaged in your car if it's really hot.
Well, yeah, you know, like the laptop computers or any electronic stuff or with batteries in it, don't leave them in there, because if it gets really, really hot, it might blow up those things. I always recommend to people, a lot of people, you know, if you're going to park your car, leave a little bit of the window open. You know, try not to leave anything in your car. Just take everything out of your car, like, you know, your personal stuff and that, and then just leave the window a little bit open so at least some breeze goes through on both sides, not just one window.
And, of course, I mean, this one's just common sense. Don't leave kids or pets in a parked car in the heat.
Yeah. Yeah, that is very
everybody. Everybody knows that, but it's amazing if people have to be reminded about that kind of stuff. All right, tell you what, let's take a break. When we come back, let's open the phone lines. You have questions about summer car tips or just general car maintenance. You got a funny noise in your car, you're wondering what it is. You got a problem with your car, and you want a tip from Sam. This is the guy you want to talk to, Sam M. Lanny. He knows everything. I've never seen this guy ever get stumped on a question about something wrong with your car. So phone me up right now, 604-280-9898. Toll free everywhere in BC, 1-877-399-9898, *9898 in your cell. Back with your calls right after this. All right, let's go right to your car questions to Sam M. Lanny. Vic, hi.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah,
go ahead.
Yes, sir. I mean, in the near future, I'm interested in picking up a Hyundai,
uh-huh,
a Sonata. And what's your opinion for them? It's 2006.
Okay. Well, Hyundai has come a long, long way.
I noticed that.
From, like, the first one that they ever made. Pony was the first one I think they made, wasn't it? Or close to it. They've come a long ways, and they are a good car. I've not heard anything, personally, anything bad about it, so I would say if you like the car, I would try it. Just make sure. I always recommend to everybody, when you're buying a used car, get an independent opinion. Take it to your mechanic, whatever, and get them to check it out properly. The things you need to make sure that they're good are, you know, your brakes, your shocks, compression on the engine, making sure that there's no rust or it hasn't been in an accident. Those are the things you want to check.
What would an honest garage typically charge you for that? Just to give a once-over to a used car.
Usually it's about between $98 and $125, but well-spent money.
Okay, Kevin on the open line. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I've got a 2000 Sunfire, which, believe it or not, has been a great car. I've got a ton of kilometers on it, but I have an oil leak right down at the dipstick tube.
Yeah.
Any way I can fix that without having to jump the car?
The oil leak, is it coming from the dipstick or the valve cover? Do you know?
Okay, I'm about as mechanical as I am good looking. So
okay, the best thing...
It's right where the, right at the bottom of the tube itself.
Yeah.
It goes into the... pan or whatever?
Yeah, the problem with oil leaks is that, you know, they could be anywhere, and as the oil runs down, you see it at the bottom, you see it at the lowest point. So what I always usually recommend, it costs you between $45 and $65 to get that engine completely shampooed. And then what you do is once you get it shampooed, you can keep an eye on where it comes. Make sure you get it checked like the day after or 2 days later. If it's the dipstick, there's basically just a rubber that you have to buy, the housing, and put a new rubber in it. If that's what it is, it could be the valve cover. That's not very expensive either to do.
What about a head gasket? Could it be a head gasket?
Very, very unlikely. It could be, but in my opinion, those engines, I have not seen too many of them.
Yeah, because believe it or not, I go through about a quart of oil every 350 clicks.
Yeah. So they've got a bit of a leak, but it's not huge.
Okay, Kevin, good luck with that. Those oil leaks can be pretty brutal. I remember when I was a kid, I had an old Bondo buggy, and it used to leak oil. I just destroyed my dad's driveway.
Yeah, oil leaks.
Really bad. He was furious. But I couldn't stop it.
Yeah. Well, the thing is a lot of times, you know, oil leaks are from two or three different places, and you got to start with one. And then go on to the other ones. And, yeah, it can get expensive. That's why I tell everybody, you know, get the engine cleaned out so then we can start of where it's coming from right off the bat instead of guessing at it.
Okay, Fred on the open line. Hi.
Hi, Sam. I love your company because the only thing I know about my car is where the gas goes. So that's my question. Is there a difference between all these different – Shell has this new V formula gas and all these different high-octane ones. Is there a difference?
Yes, there is. What it is, I'm not an engineer, but from what my knowledge of the gas is like, you know, you've got the unleaded, you got the Supreme, then you got the V, then you got the Tecron. Okay. It has additives in it for different cars, make it better. If you're driving, like, say, a sports car, like a Porsche or Ferraris or like the new engines on Cadillacs and all of those, I'd try and use the most highest grade gas you can get because it has more octane in it. You know, the old cars, you can go with the regular unleaded. It's not a problem. It does make a difference because of this octane ratings.
Al on the open line. Hi.
Hi. Just have a question about a 1998 GMC Safari 4.3 Vortec engine.
Yeah.
At 62,000 kilometers, 2,000 kilometers after the warranty was finished, it developed an engine miss in the number 6 cylinder.
Yep.
Thousands of dollars trying to find it, and most people come up with some idea. Some say it's the EGR valve. We've driven across Canada, only does it for a high load, 95 kilometers an hour, or climbing a hill. In Dryden, Ontario, a guy said he had a suggestion. He said he parked his down the street with the keys in it for 2 weeks, hoping somebody would steal it. Another person told me the best thing to do with it is to just drive it off a pier.
Well, I'm not gonna give you that advice. But we've had a few instances on that. Does your check engine light come on?
Yes, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you'll actually feel the miss and it won't come on at all. Yeah. Other times you won't even, you'll feel look down and the engine light will be on.
When
it only does it every, like, it doesn't do it all the time. It'll go like 10 months and it'll do it for a month.
Okay. when that engine light comes on, get it in and get them to diagnose the computer to find out what it is.
It number, comes up with...
Number six missing, right?
Engine, yeah, what is it?
Okay, have you had the coil changed on it?
Not the coil, just about everything else.
Okay, that's what I usually suggest to people is get somebody to check that coil out. I had one about a year and a half ago, and it was on the number five cylinder. Was doing this almost the same thing. It was just when it get to high speed, it would miss, and sometimes you wouldn't even notice it, and sometimes you would notice it. And he had already changed the plugs and a bunch of other stuff. So I said, why don't we try a new coil on that one and wires and try it out. And knock on wood, it's been a year now that he hasn't come back and, you know, yelled
all
at
right.
me.
Al, good luck with that. Sounds to me, Sam, like it might be time for the Craigslist ad and, you know, a little caveat emptor there and buy a new car.
Well, it should be. 64,000 kilometers is not a lot of kilometers.
Well, that's true.
Sorry.
Poor guy. I feel sorry for him.
Yeah, but you can't fix it. See, a lot of times, and this is one thing, Michael, that I always emphasize to people, when you take your car into a garage, doesn't matter who you take it, whether you take it to us or a dealer or, you know, anybody. When you take your car in, just let them do the diagnosis. Don't diagnose it for them. Like, tell them, okay, this is what it's doing. Can you tell me what is wrong with my car? You get a lot of customers that come in and say, oh, I think my car is missing. Just adjust the timing on it.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, if you're going to go in and tell them what to do, then they
let
won't
the
ex- do
Let
problems.
The experts do their job.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a break. More of your calls coming up. Stick around. There's tons of calls for Sam. And Margaret on the open line. Hi.
Hi. Something that has happened to me twice in the last 2 days, and mm-hmm. I'm sure it's related to the heat. After being at a stop sign, say, and I start up, it hesitates. It feels like it's going to cut out, and then you sort of limp along looking for a place to pull over, and then...
What kind of car is it, ma'am?
And then it just picks up, and away you go.
Yeah.
You know, but it's...
What kind of car is it, ma'am?
Oh, it's a 89 Tercel.
89 Toyota Tercel. So it's got most likely fuel injected or carbureted.
Oh, don't ask me.
Yeah, I would get the you know, just quickly. I would get the
carburetor, I think. But
yeah,
I
would get that checked out. You might be that if it's a carburetor, you may have a little problem with that. Or when was the last time you had a tune-up on it?
Well, this spring sometime.
In the spring this year?
Yeah.
Well, it should be under warranty. Get them to look at it for you.
Oh, okay, the carburetor.
Yeah, but it should be under warranty. That's what I'm trying
to
say.
The tune-up. The tune-up should be under warranty, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
we usually give a year warranty on tune-ups, so I'm sure most of our competitors do the same thing.
Yeah, good advice. Margaret, take that back. Tell me, look, you just got a tune-up on the thing. Come on. There must be a warranty on that thing. Mary, we got one more call. Mary.
Yes, this is her husband.
Okay.
Okay.
I've got a Dodge Caravan, and it's 98 when I bought it, and... It's an intermittent thing, very hard to explain it. It just goes...
You'll have to explain it in like 20 seconds.
It only stays on for about 3, so there you go. It's just similar to a belt noise, or it could be, I don't know what it is, that's why I'm
asking. He doesn't know what it is, Sam. Is it a belt noise or something?
Well, it's kind of hard.
What do you think?
Kind of hard to, you know what, can you do me a favor, Michael, just get the producer to get his phone number.
Okay, sir.
And then I'll phone him off the air because I have to ask him a lot of
questions. That's very kind of you, sir. Stay on the line, give your name to the producer, and Sam's going to call you. He's going to do like a house call or like a virtual house call. Sam, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you. See you next time.
I appreciate it. All right, Sam M. Lanny was with Minute, Tune, and Break. Like I said, that guy is never stumped. I've never heard him stumped on a question. Anyway, it's time to talk to Rebecca Scott. She's the producer of The Bill Good Show. We're going to take a look ahead to tomorrow. Hi, Rebecca.
Hey, Mike. I'm really excited for tomorrow's show. We have one of my favorite authors coming in tomorrow. His name is Michael Pollan, and he's written a number of books, his latest, In Defense of Food. And we're going to be talking to him about the nutritionism trend. That's not exactly his term, but we've all become such nutritional freaks that we've forgotten to just eat real food. Stop worrying about trans fats and omega-3 fatty acids. Just eat meat. Just eat fish. Just eat vegetables. So we're going to be hearing from him. We're also going to find out why the UBC farm is threatened. This is one of the best farmers markets in the city, and why it may no longer exist, just as we're all getting back to eating stuff that comes from the ground. We're also going to be talking cutting edge of the ledge, all political things that happened over the week, and why our world is about to get a lot smaller as we try to end our dependence on fossil fuels and oil. And then Rick Forchuk's going to wind up the work with some movie picks.
Sounds great, Rebecca. Thanks a lot.
No problem, Mike.
Rebecca Scott, producer of The Bill Good Show. My name is Mike Smith. Please check out my column in the Province newspaper. I'll meet you back here tomorrow morning. Take care.